Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our presentation in this, our 12th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. Today's reception is hosted by the WKU Glasgow Chancellor's Office. This series is coordinated by Brian Kuntz and Peggy Wright. My name's Chris Robinson-Congola, as the coordinator of the WKU Glasgow Library, I welcome you. Our speaker tonight is a resident of Eastview, Kentucky. Her mother is a native of Hart County, and her father hails from Grayson County. As a child, she was a constant worrier and began writing as a way to control those worries. After graduating from Grayson County High School in 1977, she married and had three children, and then returned to the classroom attending Western Kentucky University. She received a Bachelor's of Science in Education in 1987, moved to Hardin County, and began teaching. She later enrolled in graduate school at WKU, receiving her Master's of Arts degree in rank one in counseling. Throughout her life, she has continued to write. Writing has become her companion and therapist. She says, the poetry that's woven throughout the book has won several awards. Not only does she write, but researches old, sometimes abandoned, insane asylums. It was while during this research that she became aware of how awful women were treated in those institutions. The strange juxtaposition of these asylums and women's suffrage forms the background of her new novel, Asylum. In the 19th century, it took five signatures to have a man committed. It took only one signature, and that of a relative, to have a woman committed. And generally, it was by a male relative. The doctor didn't even have to see the woman. She could be labeled insane, tossed into an asylum, and spend the rest of her life there. Asylum follows a young woman who travels from Scotland to an asylum where she is put to work. There she finds that those women who are labeled as deranged are no more as deranged as she is. This book that's meant to help and heal, to teach girls and women, boys and men as well, to write and talk about their worries and fears, to share their thoughts with others. Forthcoming are sequels, or two sequels, Locked Within and Mirror Mirror. Please welcome Sherry Logsdon.
Okay, can you guys hear me okay? I'm not much with a microphone. I've got such a big mouth, I usually just bellow without one, but I'll try it here. Thank you all so much for coming. And I thought a few minutes ago I didn't see many people, and I'm like, I don't know if anybody's even going to come, but thank you all so much. She did a great introduction. When I started writing, I was a worrier, and I teach eighth grade right now. I teach eighth grade writing, and I told the kids I was a worrier, and the guys jumped up and said, "Where's your sword and your shield?" And I'm like, "What are they talking about?" And I'm like, "Oh God, I'm not a warrior, I'm a warrior." And then I couldn't even figure out how to say it right. Warrior, warrior, whatever. I worry a lot. And so I worried and worried when I was a kid. I mean, I was probably the only first grader. I thought I was going to die one day. Something happened. I think I combed my hair and a little bit bled, and I heard, if I'm old, bleed, you're going to die. And so every day I waited to die. I'm in the first grade waiting every day to die. After about a month, and I did, and I figured, well, I guess I'm not going to. So I moved on to something else to worry about. But it was always something. And so an English teacher assigned a little poem to write, and she wanted it to rhyme. So, of course, I went to bed that night, and guess what? I forgot to do the poem. So then I lay there in the bed worrying about that. But it took me like 2 hours to think of that poem. And then I got to thinking, you know, all the time I was trying to memorize a poem or write a poem, I wasn't worrying. So I figured out if I wrote, I didn't worry so much. I could write and kind of occupy my mind. So that's how I really got started into writing and kind of trying to not worry so much about everything. And I'm not much on notes, so you'll catch me looking down. I usually just fly by the seat of my pants, and I thought, I'm not going to do that tonight. I'm going to try to follow this, or I'll be all over the place, but I probably still will be anyway. I love scary movies and haunted houses, and that's kind of why... When I was a kid, it's not like now. When you watch scary houses, it was haunted houses, old insane asylums. It was creature feature, Fright Night. I don't know why everything rhymed, but I was into rhymes and everything rhymed. But I loved those Twilight Zone. Now, scary is a guy in a hockey mask slashing and gashing and de-gutting everybody. But I still like those, too. I watch those. But that's not the scary like we used to have. And so I'd even catch myself watching the credits of movies to see where they were filmed. Because a lot of them, like Vincent Price, put his sister in an insane asylum. And that just, I just love that show, and I can't even think of the name of it. So that got me so interested in those old scary movies being filmed in those. So I got real interested in haunted houses and insane asylums. So between the worrying and thinking I was going insane and insane asylums, it just kind of all worked together. And so I grew up writing, kind of journaling, and writing little diary things and writing poetry. And there's poetry throughout the book. Of course, the girl in the book writes it. But the publisher said, how did you get the poetry to match the chapters so well? And I said, I wrote the poetry first, and I matched the chapters to the poetry. They're like, good Lord, I never heard of that, but it worked. And so they were really tickled with it. And I said, I kind of combined my two favorite authors. My two favorite authors, one being Charlotte Bronte, because I love Jane Eyre and the institution about her and the insane. And would you know who my other favorite author is if I'm a horror fanatic? Stephen King. So I put Charlotte Bronte and Stephen King together. Not really, but I love Stephen King. And Stephen King actually helped me, I guess, be a writer, because he is just, I know he writes some off-the-wall things, but anybody that can, you know, you think of a clown, you think of a big red nose and feet. Stephen King thinks of a clown as somebody in a sewer that goes around killing. He's off the wall. And that, I like that creativeness of his. But his first manuscript he wrote, it was rejected over 200 times. And if Stephen King, if people can tell him he's a terrible writer, then I can take it too. And so they threw it away. He, you know, finally, after 200 rejections, he threw the manuscript in the garbage and said, no more. I'm never writing again. If I'm that bad, I'm never writing again. But his wife, Tabitha, is also a writer. And she got it out of the garbage, sent it off a few times, and got it published. And that was Carrie. And to this day, if Carrie was the only thing he'd ever written, with all the movies and the remakes, he would probably still be a rich man. So I'm thinking, if Stephen King can handle 200 rejections, so can I. So that helped me to not be so afraid to go forth with the writing. So I'll get back to the asylums. As I got older, I decided I just love the asylum, so I decided I was going to start going to them. So I started traveling and actually going. Sometimes I just go to the lot, it's bare, and take pictures. Sometimes I go where they're boarded up, and I'll take pictures of where they're all boarded up. And then sometimes I go where the tours are. And they'll redo the gift shop, of course, so you can buy little trinkets, and they can sign you in and go to the restroom. But the rest of the asylums, all they do is take the asbestos out. And you can still see all the graffiti, the shackles, the chains. You can see the markings, and they're just amazing. And I go, and I spend the night. And when I first started going, I went to the historical tours because I thought, I really want to know about these asylums. But then I figured out, you know what? It's the people I want to know about more than the buildings. So to do that, I had to start going to the paranormal tours. So I took my little flashlight, and I went and started spending nights in insane asylums. And I never hear anything, I never see anything. They said I'm too skeptical, and if a ghost knocked me over on my head, I'd not know it. So I look, and I got out of one in Peoria, Illinois at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they're like, you got to wait a minute, you got to wait for somebody to come get you before you can go to your car. It was way across the parking lot. And I'm like, well, why? I can walk that far. And they're like, nobody walks across the parking lot to the car after they get out of here. And I went, oh, good Lord, I took off. And I, across the dark parking lot, I didn't even think anything about it. So I think I had myself just into these asylums to the point I don't even think about them. But I'm going to look down here, guys, to make sure I don't miss anything. But when I started spending the nights in these asylums and looking through them and started hearing the stories, I was amazed at the women, at the stories of the women in these asylums. I'll kind of say what she had said earlier. It took five signatures to put a man in an asylum. Five different doctors had to see him, sign off that he was insane, and get him put away. In the history books, it says it took two signatures to put a woman in an asylum, but everything I found showed one. And any male in her family could get a signature and get her put away, and the doctor didn't even have to see her. He could give a doctor $5, a cow, a pig, a bottle of whiskey, it didn't matter. Just give him something and let him sign it, and you were gone. And women got put in there, and then unless they had a lot of money or somebody on the outside fighting for them, they spent the rest of their life there. And once you got in there, a lot of times it was such horrible conditions, the women did go mad. Once they got in there, they just never got out. So all the inhumane conditions were terrible. So I started researching the suffrage movement. And a lot of our girls now, they think, women's rights, that just means you want to be treated like a man, no big deal. But they don't realize years ago, in the early 1800s, if a woman and a man got a divorce, the man got the children most of the time. If a woman inherited property, her husband would get the property and control of it. She really had very little, and just like being put in the asylum, she had very little say-so. So they didn't realize what all these women in the past in the suffrage movement did for women's rights to get them. And men were mistreated in asylums too. They were bad. But a lot of your men were put in there for detox, for alcoholism, and then for real mental conditions. But it just seemed like the women were put in there a lot more readily and easily than the men were. And I had a friend from Grayson County, and actually she just passed away last week. Her grandmother died in an insane asylum. Her grandmother had a child that was 10 years old, and it got kicked in the head by a horse. And when it died, she just, it broke her heart, as it would any of us. And 3 months later, after that child had died, she was still crying. And her husband's like, the house is dirty. There's nothing on the, you haven't cooked anything. You're crazy. Get up. Cook clean. And she still boo-hooed and carried on, and he just put her in a insane asylum, and she lived there the rest of her life and died there. So, when asylums started, they were called almshouses or poor houses. And that's just where they put everybody. It was a dumping ground because they didn't have old age homes. They didn't have nursing homes. They didn't have orphanages as much. So everybody got thrown in there. If you were an unwed mother, if you were epileptic, if you were deaf, if you were blind, if you were crippled, if you were an orphan, you ended up in one of these almshouses, these poor houses, or if you were poor, if you had nowhere to go. And so everybody ended up. So Dorothea Dix in the mid-1800s was a reformer. She went through and she said, oh my gosh, there are really mentally ill people in here, and all they're doing is they're just all piled in here together, and they're not getting any help. So she actually started the first really working for mental health and to get mental health institutions, asylums. And they started out wonderful. 200 people in an asylum with a staff, but before long, it was 2,000 people in that building that was meant for 200. The same staff that cared for 200 was caring for 2,000. So it started just being overloaded, underfunded, overcrowded. And there again, that's where they started just putting chains on them. They started all the old treatments. And people started becoming guinea pigs because they started lobotomies. They started cold therapy treatments, hydrotherapy treatments. And, for instance, electric shock therapy. You would think the humane thing would be, I don't even know the voltage, I'm just guessing. You start at 100 volts and that doesn't help. Move it up to 200. That doesn't help. Move it up to 3. Back then, they started at 1,000, boom. the person drops dead, fried them. Well, that was too much. Let's move it down a little bit. Then they'd turn it down a little bit, but until it didn't fry them anymore. Because they had so many, they could lose several. It was actually better. They could get rid of some of them in there. And then, so they went to the extreme of using them as guinea pigs and people dying. And they went up until 1900. Most of your people in your asylums were just little stone markers. They didn't even have their names on the graves. And then at the 1900s, they started actually putting their names on the markers. And closer and closer to the day, they started getting better and better about shipping them back home or actually putting a nice marker on their tombstones. So it's taken years and years to get them, I guess, cared more about. But one of the asylums I went to was in Peoria, Illinois, and it was awesome. But it had a terrible name. It was called the Peoria Hospital for the Incurable Insane. Now, why you would say incurable if you're trying to talk to somebody, you know, about getting better? But the superintendent there took all the bars off the windows, and he made a zoo on the grounds, and he put animals in it. And that way the staff there, the patients, their family could all come in and see the zoo. He took all the restraints out and hung them on his office walls and started using psychoanalysis and therapy and talking to the patients. And he was the first one ever to put women in charge of the men's wards. There had always been men in charge of men. But he wanted his nurses to go and actually be doctors and put his nurses in charge. So he was really a humane doctor. And that was odd back in the early 1800s, you know, to do that. And he actually visited these almshouses and got mentally ill patients to come to his asylum. And he got one called Rhoda Derry. I want to make sure I don't miss anything and look at the time because I can go on. I'm getting off of my book some, but I'd like to tell you how just some of these asylum stories, because that's what got me so into all this. Rhoda Derry was 17 years old, and this was back in the 1800s. And she was getting ready to marry a farm boy. Well, the farm boy's mother didn't like her, hated Rhoda Derry. So she told her, she put a curse on her and said, "The devil's in you. You are now possessed." Well, Rhoda Derry scared her to death. She dropped on the ground, foam out of her mouth, having a seizure. What they think was she was either epileptic and the stress brought it on, or she just was so terrified she had a seizure. Her mom and dad really thought she was possessed by the devil, so they put her in an almshouse, in a poorhouse. So Dr. Zellers went to this almshouse and found her there. They had put her in a Utica box. And a Utica box is like short to the ground, and it looks like a baby bed, but the lid has bars that lock on it. She's curled up in a little ball, because it's very tiny, with no clothes on her side, and underneath is a tray with straw, and that's where she goes to the bathroom, and that's where the vermin, the rats, they live there, off of her feces and stuff. When Dr. Zellers got there, she had been there for 40 years. They had fed her through a tube in her mouth and had left her there. He got her out, and he sent her on a train back to his asylum. So he said, and he went around doing this all the time, finding people. So when it got back to Peoria, the nurses opened up the big box car and they start helping the women off. And then back in the corner is a laundry basket, and they're like, "What's in the laundry basket?" So they go back there and they open the towel up, and there's Rhoda Derry, because her knees have grown to her chest and she's grown into a ball where she is atrophied for that many years. So Dr. Zellers gets her out. They build her a little flat wood board with wheels on it, put her on her belly, and she flaps her arms and goes all over the place on her stomach. But I forgot to tell you, sometime through those 40 years, she had scratched her eyes out. And they don't know if that's so she wouldn't see her environment, or if the devil, you know, they used to say the devil would come in through your eyes. So she couldn't see. So I'm at 1 o'clock in the morning with my little flashlight at Rhoda Derry's tombstone, and they're telling this story, which is all true, and you can look her up on the internet. And she fell in love with Dr. Zellers as a caregiver, not as a husband, and he made sure she had fine linens and great food, and she had the run of the place. And somewhere along the line, she fell in love with chewing tobacco. So there, all the story they tell you. Then here's the little ghostly part they put at the end. Now, if you feel a tug at the bottom of your pants, because she's down low on that little cart, and you smell chew in the back of her, Rotary's here visiting you. So everybody run, and I'm like, I was just holding my breath, hoping I did, but I didn't. So that's the kind of things on paranormal. They'll tell you the truth, but then they'll add a little ghostly thing to it. But I'll switch over to my book and back a little bit. My book, I had a publisher in, is from Washington State. And when you write a book, you think, I've written a book. That's the hardest part. Oh, that's not the hardest part. Getting it out there and going with it. But I actually had done my own cover, and I put a little asylum up here in the corner, and I made a little building down, a little driveway down. And then my publisher says, if that's at Barnes & Noble's or whichever bookstore, and you look all the way across the room, it's going to be a blur. So my publisher put this big eye here. And this is Isabel, the 16-year-old girl. And I'm like, it draws you. So a publisher really, they can really help you. So the eye, they said, if that's all the way across the room, that eye's going to draw you in, not, be a blur. So I'm like, cool. I had a whole different name. They said asylum was the number one Googled name 3 years ago. So if they Google asylum, they might find you accidentally if they don't know about you. So they switched the name to asylum. Then the window, when you also, this girl goes in there and she has no family. She finds all these women in this asylum, and she actually finds asylum within herself. She finds a kind of home there. So the bright light coming out is the asylum she finds within herself in the asylum. So it's kind of funny how publishers can do all this stuff that, you would never think of. So they've worked on all that, and I was like, I'll take it. So, I'm working on the second one now, Locked Within, and it's going to take the characters, these women, and I'm going to keep trying to write books that have to do with the characters that come out of each one of these books. And one of my other heroes I didn't talk about is Nellie Bly. Nellie Bly was a journalist from the 1800s, and she was in New York. And she just, her journalist, the head of the newspaper, wanted to get her in Blackwell Insane Asylum up there to find out what really went on in there. Because every time they did an investigation, it looked peachy keen. But people were dying and dying and dying, and it was really a bad place. So all she did was go around going, who am I? Where am I? Who are you? And then the judge slapped her and said, you're crazy, put her in a paddy wagon. She said the six or eight women she was with, she said none of them were insane. Three or four of them were immigrants that couldn't speak English, and that's why they put them in there, because they couldn't speak English. So they shipped them all off to Blackwell Island. And when she got there, the old asylums all look like big old castles, and they're cold and tall. They put her in there, they lined all the women up, and at the end of the line, like here, they had a bathtub of water with a matron here with a towel, a little burlap towel. Each woman walked up, got in that tub of water, they dunked her under, wet her hair, got her out, dried her off that little burlap, threw a little nightgown over her head, moved her on over. Every woman got in the same tub of water. So the 30th woman back, the water was black, crusty. She was much worse off. If the woman in front of her had sores, was sick, you just got in their water. So then they put you in the bed. So a lot of those women died of exposure. She said the little blanket they gave her, if you pulled it up to her chin, her feet stuck out. If you covered up her feet, it showed her, up here. And so she said it was freezing. And she said a lot of the women she went in there with and met had died from exposure. And it's called 10 Days in a Madhouse. And it's on the internet for free. It's 75 pages long. If you Google that, you can read it. And it's all about this asylum. And it's awesome. And so what she ate was stale bread with little worms in it, like it's in the meal. The meat was, she said it stunk, it was rotten, and they had brown water they called tea. And she said a lot of the women got sick from that, and she said they were hit on and beat on. So that's why I'm saying if you were not mad when you went into the asylum, you were after you were there. And she said after about 3 days, if she had not known they were going to come get her in 10, she would have never made it. But she kept holding out for 10 days because she knew in 10 days they were going to come get her. And they did come get her out, and she got $1 million a year allocated to the mentally ill in New York City. So every year. And she's the same one. I think later on she went around the world in 80 days. She was an adventuress. So Nellie Bly. But she got a lot started. So there's women that have really worked for the mentally ill and the mental health of women. So I think to this day, the same $1 million, they still allocate that every year to Blackwell Island. And my book, really, what it's about is this young girl going into an institution. It doesn't tell you all about asylums, but there's an asylum in West Virginia. And I put it there because I thought you could hide anything in the mountains of West Virginia. And it's a little private asylum. And this girl in Scotland's father is cruel and just sends her over here. And I have her going through Ellis Island. That just amazes me, all through the immigration that come through there and all the immigrants. And she ended up with a man over here being her sponsor that was as mean to her as her father. He takes her to work here at this asylum, and there's 42 women. And it goes through a few of those women's lives there in the asylum and why they're there and what happened to them there and a young girl that's put in there. And it tells you about their lives. And it's real interesting because everything in the book, it's written as a fiction, but it's full of facts. It's full of research. And it's really good. Middle school girls, high school girls, they'll learn all about Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, Frederick Douglass, everybody will. I mean, I think I even put the date of the first newspaper, one of the newspapers in there. I was trying to put as much educational stuff, and you don't know you're getting educated because it just kind of falls in there, but it also teaches some things. And like I said, the poetry, this young girl, what I was trying to tell young people and everybody is, if you hold stuff in, you think you're the only person that feels it. You know, sometimes you think I'm crazy or my family is the worst. When I wrote this, the first thing my family said is, oh my God, did you write that about us? And I said, I changed the names to protect the guilty. But but people are scared to death. But that's what, you know, people think. Other people, they don't realize everybody goes through a lot of the same things. And by writing and talking and sharing, you figure out you're not crazy as you think you are, or your life's not as bad. Especially a lot of the younger people. I teach 8th grade writing, and Lord, if I wasn't insane, I am now, because that's killing me. Those between 8th grade and writing all day, they just think it's just me. And so the more I try to get them out there to write a little, to share their thoughts, to journal, you know, the better I think they'll be than holding it all inside. And I didn't bring a book. I'm going to grab a book. I'm going to read one of the poems in here, the first one. It's called The House, and it's called The House because I actually wrote it before I wrote the book. But then now I consider it to be more the asylum. So now I have to find it, guys. Here it is. Standing high upon the hill, its features cold and gray, a house that held inside its walls a child who could not play. She could not play, for she was but a prisoner in a cell, who had to do what she was told, but never could she tell. Not only could she never tell, but never could she see the way that other children played, the way that it should be. To play as if a beauty queen with powder and a purse, or mending scratches on a doll just like a real-life nurse. Her world was but a darkened room, madness filled the air. To see it for the way it was, her mind would never dare. So now she's gotten far away, but peace she'll never find, for terrors hidden in the house now hide inside her mind. And it's just talks about sometimes things that are terrible, they're in your mind as much as they're in a place. And I think there's about 32 little poems like that in there that the girl writes, and then another girl journals. So it's kind of a helpful book. It's a good read, I think, and a helpful book, and it doesn't go deep a lot, but the second one, I'm hoping to put a little bit more meat into it and a little bit more about it. Here in Kentucky, there are four asylums: Eastern State, Western State, Central State, and Waverly Hills, which actually is a sanatorium for TB, or it was. And those are the four big ones. And in Grayson County, where I'm from, when we were kids, that's what you got threatened with. If you don't straighten up, we'll put you in Hopkinsville. You know, they used to threaten you with insane asylums. You know, that's where they're going to put you. And when you go back and do genealogy, even, sometimes you'll find where someone's died, and then a few years later, they'll reappear. And what has happened is they were put in an insane asylum, and they would rather tell you they were dead than in an asylum. That's how bad the stigma was attached to it. So if you ever do it and find somebody magically reappeared from the dead, they may have been in an asylum and then, you know, somehow did get out, actually, and got put back on the census. The Ridges is an asylum in Ohio, and that's where I'm going next. And I'd read about that and talked to them. There was a young woman that escaped from there, and they thought she'd ran off and got off the grounds. And a janitor, several years later, got up in the attic looking for something, and there was the silhouette of her body on the wooden floor. She had gotten herself locked in up there and starved to death and died. And then when she decomposed, it had just stained, her silhouette had just stained the floor there. And when they clean all that, you can still see her shape. And they take people up there now to, you know, those are the kinds of things you see in asylums. And in Dunning, Chicago, there is a subdivision. They said there's 36,000 bodies buried under that subdivision. It used to be an asylum there. So there's lots of exciting things, and not everybody thinks an insane asylum is exciting, but I do. There's a lot of history in it and a lot of just, you know, different things. And the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, I spent the night there, and that's where Ghost Hunters was last week, or their first week back, and it's 9 acres large. The only masonry building larger is the Kremlin, and it is huge. And I went all through there, and they had the morgue and the dentist, and they had the grocery, they had the hole. And in the 60s, President Kennedy went there, and he hurt them instead of helped them, but he didn't realize it because they were putting them to work. And he said, you can't make these people work. The state pays for them to be here, or they pay, their families pay. And you can't make somebody that's being paid to be here work. So they quit letting them work. Well, then several of them killed themselves because that was their livelihood. They were working and had a purpose to their life. So when they just sat all day, then, so, you know, there's been a lot of good, bad, different things going on. But I'm about talked out. It's all going all day. I guess questions, is there any, you know, I haven't slowed down any for questions, or is there anything you guys want to know about anything?
I missed, he said, what century or what time period?
Oh, I didn't. You didn't miss it. I didn't say. The book was written in 1896 to 1920, and I guess the back of it goes a little bit above that. But it was a time right around 1900, so much happened, and that's when in the 19th Amendment went through and women got the right to vote. So I just kind of timed it around that, but it was the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century. And that's why I said I kind of go into the Jane Eyre thing, and then I do the Stephen King thing and try to kind of throw them together. The next book, I said Locked Within. I'm taking one of the characters, and then I'm going, she's a big rallier, a women's rights rallier, and they took them, broke the rallies up, and put them in jails. Then they force-fed them in the jails, they mistreated them in the jails, beat them, treated them like criminals, and I'm going through there, and I'm going to have, I've got a little dwarf woman in that one who is a big, powerful rallier, and I've also got a spiritualist in the next one, because in the 1800s spiritualism was big. A lot of the women did, they got their afternoon teas, they did seances, and they tried to pull up the dead and the ghosts. And I'm not going to turn it into a ghost story, but I did want to put that little bit in there where one of the ralliers is a big spiritualist, and we talk about a little bit of spiritualism in there and what happened then. So I'm trying to add with these women, each one, more and more things like that that happen. Yes, ma'am.
Once you've got your idea, about how long did it take you?
Well, I tell everybody it's taken me 25, 30 years to write this book, because it really has. I collected all my writings, and I started writing those poetry. But once I decided, hey, this might make a good book, probably about a year, year and a half to put it all together. But I pull things. I tell the kids at school, just like art, don't ever erase anything. Don't throw anything away. I have papers all over my house, boxes and boxes. And I might pull out a box and get one sentence from it, but that was the perfect sentence that fit in here. And it's like, I don't throw anything away. And my grandson came to my house the other night, and he looked around and he said, "Oh God, Nana, I think you might be a hoarder." And I was like, "Oh my God, it's getting bad." And I looked at him and said, "I hope not, Kyler, but maybe you're right." So I'm like, I've got one library in my house that's all 1,800 books, because I don't want to use a word and it not been a word then. And I'm afraid to use, like, books that are written now back in the 1800s. I'm afraid that person messed up. So if I write about an heir, I actually will research the books from that time period, 1847. So I've probably got a library about this big or bigger in my house with 1,800 books from the 1800s. And I'll read them and just get words from them and inspiration, and I'll read something, and that'll give me an idea. And I can't lay in bed at night and think what I'm going to write tomorrow, because when I sit down at the computer and start writing, boom, I never know what's going to come out of my mind. It just like take a life of its own, and I just write, and some of the weirdest things. And people I know will read my book and say, "How did you think of that?" And I'm like, "Lord, I don't know. I just got to writing and out it came." So it just... And I tell the kids get mad at school because I make them write every day. 10 minutes, the first period, they have to keep a writer's journal. Every day. And, oh, you would think I had a bullwhip up there just beating them to death. They moan and groan. But that's what I found out about writing. It's like a treadmill or exercise. If you don't do it every day, it becomes a chore. But if you write and write and write, it's like practicing for a violin or, you know, practicing baseball. You get better and better and better. But you got to sit down and do it, you know. If not every day, a whole lot. Or because if you get out, it's just not... It's hard. You'll look at that typewriter and think, "I got to write." Ugh. And you won't. But once you get to doing it, it's more, I guess, fun. And then, so. Yes, sir.
How did you kind of accept the main character as coming from Scotland? Where'd
you get that? Oh, I'm like, the reason I picked the girl coming from Scotland is I watched a movie called The Magdalene Sisters. It was about an asylum in Scotland, and it was unwed mothers were put there. And if the girls were raped, it didn't matter. The guys, they were okay. They sent the girls to this asylum. They had their babies. They took them away from them, and off they went. So they put all these young unwed mothers in this asylum. And I saw that, and then... I just got so interested in that, so I started researching. And every name I give somebody, I don't just give them a name to be given them. Isabel, I would probably rather not been such a, I don't know, maybe I'd rather have been an older name, but that's an old one. But the reason I named her that is Isabel Gowdy is a witch from Scotland. She is the most renowned witch there ever was in Scotland. So this girl's father felt like she was a witch, so he named her after Isabel Gowdy, the most famous witch in Scotland. So every time I gave a character a name, it was for a reason. Just like, you know, that was because it was a witch's name. Yes, sir.
I know that Nellie Bly was also involved at around the same time with some of the prison reform that was going on in New York City also.
Right.
I'm wondering if there was finding the research that there was communication between the prison reformers and those who were reforming the asylum.
Yes, and that's kind of why my second one's going into jails and prisons, because I'm going to kind of tie Nellie Bly back into the second one with the prison reform and all that. And it's and just like when we went to West Virginia to this big asylum, they're like 100 miles north of here is an old prison that has all kinds of hauntings in it, you know. So a lot of the old prisons and the old asylums, because lots of people died there and were mistreated, so they tied them in a lot, and they were treated a lot the same. And yes, ma'am. Yes. No, you know that this has probably been edited 40 times, but it was always, they didn't change anything in my book except there was a chapter that they said I did not use transitions. I was like bewitched. I was here and then I was here, and they were like, you didn't use good transitions. You never told me how you got from here to here. So I had to go through that chapter and put in some better transitions. And so, you know, things like that. And then I started putting commas to death. And they wrote back and said, do not put another comma in that book. They said, the new, is it APA they're going by? It's cutting out a few commas. You don't put so many commas. They said, when we said edit, we do not mean that. Do not touch it. So they started fussing at me for going back. And if they hadn't said stop, I probably would never have finished it. Because every time I got it back from them, I thought of something else to put in there, a little more exciting, or I'd stick it in there. Well, that would throw the whole thing off. So finally they said, we're done. Don't edit. You're done. But it was over a year back and forth editing it, but they did keep all my, other than my transitions, they kept the original. And I honestly sent this in more as an outline. I had a lot more to say, but they got it and they said, no, in this time period now, people like a book, they like to read it and move on. And I know not everybody does. Some of us big readers like big, thick books. But they said, especially the young crowd now likes to read a book and move on. They said, hook them and then you can put all that meat in the second one. And actually, it's true about the young people, because they have really had a little girl from the middle school wrote me and said, oh my God, it's perfect, perfect, perfect. I've read it three times. I love it, love it, love it. And I'm like, okay. So it was just, they like where they can move on through, and it's not a lot of description and a lot of where it bogs them down, where, you know, where you'll get to a part of description and just kind of go through it and you'll... And there's nothing in here, like, I found no need for cursing or sex acts. If a child was too young to understand this, that would be the only problem. There would be not anything in it that would be bad for, like, if a sixth grader picked it up and read it. It would only be that she didn't understand, or he didn't understand some of the issues these women were going through. But there's nothing in there that's, you know, that would be bad for them to read. And I just never did find the need to put that anywhere in here, because I was just focusing on these women and what they'd gone through more than anything else. So, and my publisher did go bankrupt in the middle of this, and boy, that has been a nightmare in itself. But they were like the top five publishers. But when you get a publisher, you really, they had sold it somewhere in there after they'd gotten my book. And so it's being picked up again by another one. But it's just a hard, you know, writing it should be the hardest part, but it's not. Yes, ma'am. Yes, I'm going to keep the same characters, some of them, and add more. Norna is a young woman in here who's a journalist from New York, and for some reason I just dropped her. I didn't really drop her. I didn't do a lot with her, but everybody's like, oh my God, we thought she was going to end up in the asylum. You just dropped her. And I'm like, oh, I didn't think of it. So I picked her up, and then she's going to be the focus of the next one. And then I'm going to use some of the other women and add more. And then the third one, I'll use some of the women and add more. Yes?
And is it also going to stay with us all, or are you going to just take it?
No, I'm going to keep asylums. I think I'm going to keep some of the asylums. And I would like to, like when I revamp this, I'd like to put a big like 1 slashed across here. And then the asylum 2 have a big 2 on the front. You know, and it's, you don't have to go into the inside of the book to know which one's first, which one's second. And all of them be a series of the asylum with the different ones. And then just have... And Mirror Mirror is also about one of the young girls in here in the asylum. One of them that's older. And then that was kind of about her, where she looks in a mirror and stuff, so it sees different things.
So
it's mostly just changing perspectives?
Yes, that's exactly. It's because it's even the prologue of the second one is this, it tells a whole lot of this one from a different character's perspective, and that's exactly what it is. I'm just changing perspectives of how people saw what happened. So.
Have you written any books of poetry, or do you plan to?
Well, I have about 100. My husband wanted me to actually publish a book of poetry first. And I'm terrible. I love poetry, but I kept thinking, nobody's going to read just a book of my poetry. So that's why I ended up putting a bunch of poetry in here. But I think I'm going to go back and take the other and this and do just a book of poetry. I actually listed these to where you could use them. There's 32 in here, and just pull them out and use them. But I do think I'm going to go ahead and just do a book of poetry and as well.
Any more questions? Maybe one
time for
one more question.
Yes,
right here.
How old were you, Sherry, when you decided you and our family were crazy?
Say that's right. Not very old, you know? You pretty well know your family's got problems from a little age, and you think, does other families act like that? Do they do that? So, I knew pretty young, we were born. So.
On behalf of our friends organization, and token of our appreciation for your talk tonight.
Thank you very much.
We want to very much thank you.